next matter on our court's calendar is A18-1236, State of Minnesota. Appellant is Andrew Joseph Casserly, State of Minnesota respondent. And if counsel, once you approach the podium, will introduce yourself for our record, and as soon as counsel for appellant is ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Melissa Haley. I'm here representing Andrew Casserly on a judgment out of Dakota County District Court. He was convicted of a third-degree burglary about a year ago after a jury trial. And I've raised two issues on his behalf. One is the sufficiency of the evidence with the circumstantial evidence heightened scrutiny standard. And the second is the adequacy of the jury instructions that were given in this case. And I know that you've already read the briefs and are familiar with the facts and all of that. So what I'd like to do is talk briefly about a couple pieces of evidence to look closely at in your review for sufficiency, and then I'd like to spend a lot of my time on the instructions issue.
Could I just jump you to that? I'm sorry, in the reverse order, I just wanted to clarify on the instruction, would you agree that the court gave the correct jury instruction both by virtue of the pattern jury instructions, which mirror the statute itself, the element that references together or with an accomplice? And there was no objection to that instruction, so on its face, the instruction would be accurate.
No, I do not agree with that assessment. What I think happened in the case, frankly, is that when they drafted the complaint, the preamble language had the directly or an accomplice language in it. And then when they were talking about the elements in the jury instruction, which was around the time before they were giving the preliminary instructions at the front end of the trial, there was an informal conversation with both lawyers and the judge where they said, well, the language says this, the preamble language, do we want to include that? And they all kind of said yes. At that point, they haven't heard any of the testimony. They haven't, heard the details of the case. This particular court uses the elements they gave in the preliminary instructions to sends them back with the jury, and they don't revisit the instructions at the close of the trial. So the state points out in her brief that the state charged burglary without aiding and abetting, right? And so their argument is that we don't need to worry about whether or not there should have been an accomplice liability instruction. But that's just one piece of what Mr. Casserly's argument is here. Worse, the other piece is that if you're looking at this instruction simply through the lens of direct liability and the burglary charge, you have to look at those elements. And what they did was take one of the elements and insert extraneous language, really, if they didn't charge accomplice liability, and we assume the state's position is correct for the sake of argument. If you look at the jury instruction guide 17.11, it is kind of a, like a lot of them, it's a menu, and the court picks the pieces that they want given what the facts are in their case, and in conjunction with talking with the lawyers. And in that case, that jury instruction, nowhere does it say this language either directly or as an accomplice. Right? So if you keep that in mind, and then you look at the way that the statute itself is written, it uses the disjunctive or the conjunctive or and lays out three or four different things that can happen that can put you in the realm of a burglary. And after the third thing, which is commits a felony or gross misdemeanor while in the building, the phrase either directly or as an accomplice modifies either that phrase in front of it or all three of those phrases, which are the pieces that I digress a little because I didn't necessarily raise a statutory interpretation issue, but all of that is relevant to say that the element in the jury instruction guide that this jury heard he stole either directly or as an accomplice is not just taking language as written from the statute. It's modifying the element, which should be he stole, period. The end of the state's brief.
But again, there was no objection to what the district court did at the time, correct?
So no. So you're looking at plain error. Yes, I agree with that. And on that issue, this error, I think, is plain because the jury needs to know exactly what the elements are, and the instructions need to be clear. And in this case, that instruction with modifying that he stole it could be directly or an accomplice conflates the intent requirement that you need for the burglary charge. In other words, Mr. Casserly, there's evidence that Mr. Casserly was present when a U-Haul was rented earlier, right? And it's disputed at trial whether or not he was present at the storage facility and what exactly he did while at the storage facility. Most of the evidence at trial talks about Jeremy Gonser, who is the person that the state believes put in the access code, who is the connection to a possible theory of how they got the keys from Lynn Hoffman, who's the storage facility owner. He is the connection between different phone records that brought Mr. Casserly into this case, right? So for all practical purposes, there's a connection between the two. The state, in closing, talks about the elements with Mr. Gonser and Mr. Casserly together. A jury, not knowing the legal definition of accomplice and perhaps using a layperson's idea of what that might be, may think that renting a van, doing a favor for somebody, is helping them. And so what may have happened with this jury is that you stole either directly with or with an accomplice allows them not to look at whether there was specific intent for this crime or that action, which is required for criminal culpability, but rather they come up with their own definition of what that means, right? You wouldn't need the word directly. You could just have he stole, but the or as an accomplice must mean something to these jurors.
Are you really essentially arguing that any time a jury instruction includes the word accomplice, that the court should be giving accomplice instructions to complement the other jury instructions?
It's a good question, but no, I'm not. And in fact, in the burglary context, there has been litigation. There have been decisions about accomplice at different places, like in the first degree section of the statute. But this is not interpreting an element as it was stated in the statute. This is where a judge or the instructions open up the possibility on specifically the intent element and include basically alternate means of liability in it. Then I do think that accomplice liability instructions should be given in that case. There was a case, I think it was 1995, State versus Ostrom. It was a burglary case where the court sua sponte gave accomplice liability instructions. Now, that circumstantial case was a little bit more traditional in that there were footprints to the back window. The back window was open. Somebody had seen the people on the porch. They said they were there for a different reason. The way that case came in, by the time they got to the jury instructions, there really wasn't evidence of the direct liability, but there was the evidence of the connection between the different people, and so the court gave instructions on accomplice liability in that case.
And what was the upshot of that? Was there an argument made that the court should not have given the account, or how did it get up to the appellate courts?
Of course, that there was an argument they shouldn't have in the Supreme Court, and the argument was it violated due process, obviously, and the Supreme Court said no. That this would have been something that somebody could have made a motion to amend the complaint, and it would have been amended based on these facts, and so it was okay in that case.
Well, in this case, would the defendant have had to consent to the accomplice instructions? to avoid the Ostrom argument?
I'm not sure the answer to that, to be honest. I don't think so, but I'm not certain of the answer.
Well, assuming you're correct, if the evidence were so overwhelming, it might be difficult to show prejudice because of an error. But you're also arguing insufficiency of evidence, so this might be a good time to...
A good segue. Thank you. This case is actually really interesting on that circumstantial because there's the cell phone records, right, are what tie my client to Mr. Gonser. And so, in other words, we don't have Mr. Gonser testifying at trial. If we did, we would have had an obstruction. He's an accomplice, so my guess is we would have had to have an instruction about his inherent lack of credibility. But the cell phone records show that there were calls between the two of them. But not the calls between the two of them are not necessarily directly related to this. We don't know the content of any of the calls. We know that there were some calls between the two different phones. One of the phones, the state argued, was his, and I'm guessing that for review, you may assume that that was his phone. The pieces to look at are Exhibit 13, which is a picture of Jeremy Gonser putting in the access codes at the North Star storage facility. And there's not... It does not appear to be somebody else in the car. That was a piece that was disputed, whether or not there was a second person at that point in time. There's surveillance videos. There's a picture. So that's all I'll say on that. But it's Jeremy Gonser that was putting in the access codes. The same thing with the U-Haul rental. I think the evidence does establish that he did rent the U-Haul, but it doesn't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily establish, or the state hasn't established that there are no reasonable other alternatives other than the U-Haul was later at North Star, and so Mr. Casserly was involved there at that point, and he knew when he went in that he was there without consent. There is some evidence in the record that he was renting a U-Haul to help somebody move. And so our position is there just is not enough evidence to support beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened the way the state is arguing and that there were no rational alternatives.
What about the video?
So Exhibits 6, 7, and 8 are the video surveillance, and the surveillance was set up so that it's stop motion. So it doesn't have everything on the video. It has bits of it on the video, right? The video would show the van and the access codes. It's hard to see on that, but that's Gonser putting in. There's a part of the video that I think shows a van leaving a building. And then there's a part where there's carts moving. The part on the carts moving, the state is arguing that my client was the person there with a hoodie and a hat. Interestingly, nobody, even the detective in the case, who obviously thinks that it's him, was not affirmatively identifying him in court. And they describe him as being a white male with a tall nose. So again, those, even assuming for the purpose of review that he was present that afternoon, the intent, what he knew and when he knew it, I think is the critical piece here. And that's why it fits in with the jury instruction and why there is such a risk that the jury did not hold the state to the burden of proving that he had the requisite intent and there were no other rational theories that could explain the conduct in this case. Did that answer the question?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to reserve any time left. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Tori Schneider, and I represent Respondent State of Minnesota. The district court did not err in instructing the jury, and there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the verdict. As Judge Sleater started, I'm going to reverse the issues as they were laid out in the briefs. This court is reviewing the jury instruction for plain error, and as Judge Shellhas was indicating, there is no plain error here. In order for there to have been error, the defendant or appellant had to have been charged with aiding and abetting this burglary. As the complaint lays out in document number one, there is no 609.05 charged. Appellant is asking this court to hold and to apply an intent requirement that is not required under the charge that he, under the offense that he was charged with.
Well, how do we know whether the jury convicted the defendant because it believed that he directly committed this crime or he committed it as an accomplice?
Well, jumping down then to the prejudice prong, Your Honor, it, not to say it doesn't matter, but because there is sufficient evidence in the record that he did commit this offense fully as a principal, because there is sufficient evidence in the record that the appellant's conduct, solely the appellant's conduct, meets all of the elements of the offense.
I understand that argument, but what I am wondering is, in any case, if you say to the jury that so-and-so committed this act himself as the principal or as an accomplice, how do we ever know that the jury understands what the word accomplice means or on what basis it finds a defendant guilty if it does, given just those instructions with no accomplice instructions?
Your Honor, not all words in jury instructions are defined, and juries are instructed every day to use common meanings of words that are left undefined. And so juries are, we entrust them all the time to use just common meanings of words. And in this case, or in any of these types of cases, I would trust that a jury can use the common meaning of accomplice.
Wouldn't this one be bigger, though, than the category of common meaning? Because we know as a matter of law, accomplice has a very specific definitional, and in fact, it can be error in a clear-cut accomplice case, let's say, where a court fails, whether defendant objects or not, fails to give that instruction can be reversible error. So would you agree at a minimum, maybe I'll just take the error out, it was a mistake to have that word in it, either in the complaint then or in the jury instruction, if that indeed is the case. And secondly, is there not a potential here, as in the Huber case, where someone's present with a moving van helping someone load because I have authority to do this? Okay, I'll help you out this afternoon. Would that not be a reason to give that accomplished instruction to the jury, because they have to find an intent by this appellant to be there to steal as opposed to be there? Therefore, the cross-examination and the arguments that I'm assuming perhaps were made anyway now have a meaning and a definition the jury's considering.
If I can Your Honor, if I can remember the first part.
I apologize for that.
It's okay. It's not an wrong to have that in the complaint. That is the language from the statute, Your Honor. All four counts of burglary state as an directly or as an accomplice, and the Minnesota Supreme Court stated in State v. Bates that there is no distinction between accomplices and principals when it comes to burglaries, that any participant in a burglary is considered a principal. So taking that statement and applying it to a burglary, I don't believe it is and would be an error or a mistake to allow a jury to use common definition of accomplice, especially in this case. So I know I cited some unpublished cases in my brief, and drawing your attention to the Zenzius case from this court in 2015, where the court had dealt with this issue, the discrepancy between the statute and the jig, where the statutes all say directly or as an accomplice, and the jig leaves that out. The district court raised that issue. The state said, well, we can amend the complaint to add 609.05. The defense said, why don't we just add the language, which is what happened in this case. And in that case, though, we did have a true accomplice or aiding and abetting situation, whereas in the instant case, appellant is the state's position that appellant was an actual direct offender. So I don't believe, the state does not believe that there was any error, or if there was an error, it was not prejudicial. It doesn't rise to the level of plain error.
Was the co-defendant charged?
I'm not sure I answered the second part of your question,
yes.
So if you could repeat
yes.
it for me.
The part about the point being is when you have that word accomplice, my question is, does not an accomplice instruction need to go to the jury so that if that is the basis they will do it, they can find an accomplice intent as required after Huber in the jury instruction?
And I believe that under State v. Bates, that would not be required because all participants of a burglary are considered principals.
That's the distinction your point
yes,
makes
your
between
Honor.
The burglary and other crimes where an accomplice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. My question I was just asking now is perhaps more out of curiosity. I understand, too, the co-defendant did not testify charged?
That's correct. He was charged at the time, and his case was still pending, so he did not testify. Again, so is the state's position that there was no error. If there was error, it wasn't plain because there was this discrepancy and nothing has been done about the discrepancy, whether through a case law or through a correction, either in the statutes or the jigs. And even if it was plain error, it doesn't rise to prejudicial or affecting the outcome of the case because there is sufficient evidence in the record that proves appellant's guilt as a principal. And so is the state's position that the district court did not err in instructing the jury. Moving on to the sufficiency of the evidence, even under the heightened scrutiny that the courts apply regarding the circumstantial evidence, there is sufficient evidence in the record to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant's guilt. First, this case does involve both direct and circumstantial evidence. There's the appellant's identification both by Marissa Mingo and Matthew Underwood at the U-Haul, and then there is appellant seen on the video recordings. So we do have direct evidence of appellant. Then there's the circumstantial evidence of the fact that appellant's phone number was placed on the U-Haul contract as the secondary phone number. When Mr. Underwood called that phone number, someone named Drew answered the phone. The detective traced that phone number to appellant's Facebook profile. And there's the fact that the subscriber of that phone number, while listed as one Michael Jordan, listed a birth date that was very similar to appellant's, with the exception of the day. Then there is the cell phone location data that counsel was referring to. However, there's much more of that than just tying appellant to Mr. Gonzer. We placed appellant's phone 1,600 feet away from the U-Haul store at the same time that appellant was at the U-Haul store renting the U-Haul, and not only at the same time, but from the cell phone tower, his phone was in the same direction as the U-Haul store, and then it was also at the same time and in the same direction at the mini storage in Burnsville as that cell phone tower at the 2097 West 144th Street tower. There that tower was only 600 feet away from the North Star mini storage. And there it was also at the same times as the burglaries. There were also linking him to a tower in Minneapolis, both after renting the U-Haul and then after the burglaries. So linking both the direct and the circumstantial evidence in this case, the evidence is inconsistent with any other rational hypotheses except for guilt. So the evidence is sufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If there are no other questions.
Okay. There are none. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. The state would respectfully request that you affirm appellant's conviction.
Very good.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, if you wish to respond, you may proceed.
On the sufficiency piece, I'd point out one thing. On the service area maps, they're Exhibit 10 and 11, and they're literally that, T-Mobile, the service area maps, and they don't by any means place him at the scene. One of them is you know, they're within 600 or 1,600 feet of the business, but there's multiple other businesses there. So as you're determining weight of that, I just wanted to point that out. Then on the response to some of the ideas brought up about the instructions, the respondent cites State versus Bates. I think for the proposition that you don't have to give accomplice, you never give accomplice liability instructions in a burglary, and because it's always charged as if they're principals. And I don't think that that's actually what Bates said. I think Bates basically addressed the idea that you could have a principal and an accomplice, and they both would be charged and punished accordingly. In other words, there wouldn't be a lesser aider and a primary person, that both would be charged and punished accordingly. Since that was a 1971 case, since then we had the Ostrom decision, which I mentioned earlier, which clearly indicates that you can use accomplice liability in a burglary case. And we, in 2007, I think that's when the burglary statute was amended to refer to either direct or accomplice. And the legislature, in putting that language in there, I think was clarifying that you can be a principal or an accomplice in a burglary case. The other piece I would address is this idea that because that statutory language has not come through the courts yet, that this can't be plain error. This is plain error because the jury instructions have to correctly state the elements of the offense. And this case, they did not. If you're looking at what the state says they were doing, which was the principal burglary charge, it should have said he stole and not had the extraneous statutory language that opened up the door for the jury to consider whether or not he could be an accomplice, whatever that meant to them, and hold him liable on something less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt on the intent element in a principal burglary charge. So unless you have questions, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your written and oral statements made and comments. We'll take the matter under advisement. You each have a good day. Lauren, do you want to check to see if counsel are here? Thank you. Yeah, we're about 20 minutes ahead. You want to do that? Should we just do that? Okay.
Then we'd have a longer break.
Yeah. That's a good point.